Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Nice.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I'm your host, Gene Turnbow. Susan Fox has the week off. With me is a very special guest, and it's a man I have respected greatly since I was a child. Please welcome the one and only Santa Claus.
Hello there. Bless my buttons and jumping jingle bells. Gene, I am so happy to come and join you.
I'm so pleased to have you here. It's really quite an honor.
Well, call me Nicholas.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I'm a fan of your show and the station, of course. Santa's a huge geek, and many of the elves up the North Pole listen to it as well.
I'm impressed. My gosh.
I'm sorry that officially they probably don't show up in your numbers. I wish they did. We have to have a certain amount of confidentiality considering what we do.
Yes, I can imagine that's so. You have been extremely busy this year, maybe busier than other years.
Well, yes, I've been pretty busy for some time. I visit roughly about 233 million homes. And so at the North Pole, we have a schedule that's done in decades, years, months, so on and so forth. And at this present time, we're getting ready for our big delivery. You know, I actually visit on several nights depending on what country and what tradition they celebrate. But, you know, Christmas Eve, of course, is the big night.
So it's... I've always wondered about the physics of it.
All right. Well, if you insist, let's get a little geeky. So I visit roughly 233 million homes. Or, well, it stops, actually, because I visit several households when I do a stop. I have about 32 hours to deliver all my presents. And my sleigh moves, the Mark 42, moves at 1,800 miles per second. Or we're traveling roughly around Mach 8. A lot of people think we go faster than the speed of light, but that's kind of a misnomer. Santa has that whole timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly thing going. So we have some technology, time splicer technology. If you were to see the sleigh in flight, essentially you'd see a dot of light get over a city, then that there'd be a flash, and then the dot would move on. And what that is happening, what's happening is I'm hitting my time splicer and boom, going into all the different homes, creating my own pocket time stream, and then they all come back, join back up, and then boom, I move on to the next one.
I was wondering how that worked. It's like, gosh, pocket time streams.
Well, okay. Well, first of all, as you know, time is essentially a dimension. And once you have the right magical technology, or technology advanced enough, as Asimov would say, you can play a few games. And so I have a little leeway, but roughly I have 32 hours. And so it requires a lot of work, to be honest. I visit roughly 390,000 homes per second.
Oh, gosh. That is a lot.
Oh, 361,300,000 metric tons of gifts per year. And roughly about 700 quintillion joules of energy. I'm eating about 300 calories per household and drinking about 60 Olympic pools of eggnog, 740 million tons of cookies, and, you know, we're using, oh, I'm guessing 1.8 million miles of wrapping paper for roughly 3.7 billion presents. So I'm hitting a lot of places.
You have been around a long time. How, if you don't mind my asking, Nicholas, how old are you?
That's a very good question. I was born March 15th, 270 AD, and I am now 1,748 years old, give or take.
And that's not counting the time you spend in the pocket universes.
Right. Well, it all adds up eventually. So what happened was I was born in what is called Patara. It was part of the Byzantine Empire in Turkey, and what is now called Turkey. It was back then it was part of the Roman Empire. And so what happened was is my parents passed away when I was around 10 years old, and they were merchants. I was kind of a Greek anchor baby for that part of the world. And I had an uncle who belonged to this weird little cult called Christianity. It was just getting off the ground. And but I liked the message, and so I became part of the tradition. And when I was around 19 years old, one of the people had a vision that whoever walked through the gates at this first thing in the morning would be the next bishop. Well, that was me. And so I was called the boy bishop. I was only 19 years old. That was not actually a huge boon to me because we were not a state-recognized religion at the time. And so shortly thereafter, I was thrown into jail, and it went really rough for me for a while. But fortunately, sort of, Constantine came into power. And when Constantine came into power, he decided he was going to make Christianity the main state religion, mainly because he wanted the Christians to be involved in all his designs for expanding his empire. But he ran into a little problem there in the fact that now he was trying to get all the Christians together, but none of them were all reading from the same handbook. And so he had the Council of Nicaea, and the rumor is, which I am not going to confirm, that I went over the table and punched another bishop in the nose.
Oh, gosh.
Well, St. Nicholas has been known to be feisty. So anyway, so what happens is the reputation goes on, but a lot of people forget the core myth or the core story. I shouldn't call it a myth. The core story. And you know what that is, right?
Well, I know it from my perspective.
Ah, an erudite answer. So here's the core story. When I was still young, my parents passed away and they left me a little bit of money. I heard of a father who had three daughters. Back in those days, there was hardly any social support or welfare. And so his family was starving and he was looking at either selling his daughters into prostitution or slavery. It was not a good time, mainly because he did not have a dowry. That's just the way the world worked back then. And so I heard of this, and I snuck over to his house, and I threw a bag of gold inside his house one night. A little time passes. The first daughter gets married off. Everybody's whispering about, you know, mysterious bags of gold through windows. I sneak back another week later. I throw in another bag of gold, you know, and everybody's like, who is throwing these bags of gold into the house? Well, the third week, I show up, and I sneak in, and I throw a bag of gold in, whoosh, right into a stocking by the fireplace. Well, he spots me, and he looks at me, and he says, Nikolai Thaumaturgus, right? Nicholas the Wonder Worker.
Mm.
And so the reputation of targeted anonymous giving, that's the core story. And so other people started to emulate it over time. I kind of died, but it didn't stick. And so a few hundred years later, I migrate up to what was then called Hyperborea, but is now called Claws Valley. A lot of people don't realize there are three North Poles. There's the magnetic North Pole, the geographic North Pole, and the magical North Pole. And so we have our little pocket realm up there. And as humanity expanded across the globe, a lot of the what you would consider magical creatures came to move in up in Hyperborea and some other key places. And so up at the North Pole, we have mermaids and fairies and trolls and goblins and all sorts of interesting. And believe it or not, a few scientists and inventors and artists along the way decided to join us as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, the elves, when I made the Great Sealy contract with them, they saw what I was doing, and to their perspective, my targeted anonymous giving is kind of the core contract of civilization. Essentially doing something without expectation of reward. That's how the whole system works. And so they decided, hey, what he's doing seems to be helping make human beings better. And so that's that particular group decided they were going to help me. Well, they had some pretty cool magical technology themselves, and they had noticed, for instance, that reindeer in certain areas had the ability to jump further and run faster. And after long periods of observation, we found that there were certain plants that were gathering certain elements, and those certain elements could be used in a variety of very interesting ways, including sleigh technology, flying technology, and longevity.
Oh, oh my. Oh my.
Yes. But one of the things to understand is belief is a power just as is gravity and you're familiar with the concept of being observed phenomena.
Mm, yes.
Right. Well, same concept. Belief has that kind of power too. And so for me, being a legendary person, when people start talking about Santa Claus or St. Nicholas or Pierre Noël or however they the Weihnachtsmann, however they want to refer to me, I am now partially made of that belief. And so I look different wherever I am. And so down south, I might sound like I got a little bit of a southern accent. And, you know, I might look different in different countries. And I get around in different ways. In Australia, when I'm down there, I have my six white kangaroo, my six boomers. Yep. And so, and of course, on my sleigh, Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, Blitzen. Donner, it was originally Dunder and Blixen, by the way. Means thunder and lightning. And then it got changed to, that was Dutch, and then it got changed to the German. But they are my two most powerful reindeer, and they're right up close to me. And then Rudolph is not actually attached to the sleigh. He guides. And so if you ever see a red light go whoosh, past your window, that's Rudolph, you know, sneaking into the house and eating the cookies before I can get there. I'll get back up to the roof, and I'm like, really? Hey, Santa. So, to answer your question, belief and in particular creativity affects me. And so when writers and poets and singers do something that catches into the imagination of humanity, it affects me. And so strangely enough for me, what you may see as, fictional characters, to me, they are somewhat real. I actually have relationships with them. Which is interesting. And so when you talk about the whole timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly, bigger on the inside, as Santa Claus, I can kind of relate to that. I mean, when you see multiple Santa Clauses, is it just me changing my guise, or is it Santa Claus regenerating because he's a Gallifreyan Time Lord? Or, you know, if you see the elves with their pointy ears, are they, you know, strange magical creatures, or could they be Vulcans, right, with transporters and matter replicators, because that would answer the whole toy delivery problem pretty easily, wouldn't it?
Well, and I had always supposed that your sack was dimensionally transcendental.
Yes. The big bag actually is, I've talked to the elves about this, and they said, well, you take a Mobius strip, a tesseract, a Klein bottle, and some fur from Schrodinger's cat and a phase spider, and you weave it all together, and you get the big bag. And so as I get over a city, I reach into the bag, and so Des Moines, Iowa, all of a sudden the load for Des Moines, Iowa is there because the bag actually is kind of a stabilized wormhole that is going back to the North Pole where they're loading it up on the other end.
Ah, that explains a great deal.
Yes.
That explains a great deal.
I have to tell you, it's really important that the children go to bed on time because I have to be in and out of that house in a flash. And if people aren't asleep, I could accidentally run into them. And at the speed I'm moving, that could be bad. So I actually, when I travel with my sleigh, I have some companions. I've got Spike. He's one of my elves. His job,
an elf named Spike.
Spike. He's got kind of a mohawk. He's got neck tats and gauges and everything. Spike is a wonderful guy, but as scary as he looks, he is amazing with animals. And so I'll send Spike down to deal with the odd Rottweiler who doesn't care for me. And I have a fairy with me named Compass Rose who can help me when I get lost. And, of course, I'm listening to Mrs. Claus has run everything from logistics back at the North Pole. And a lot of people don't realize how important Mrs. Claus is to my whole business. She runs the joint. She's in charge of being resources. She's managing the whole logistics and supply chain. And she's in charge of the Naughty or Nice list. She has a magical gold telescope that allows her to check in on people to see how they're doing.
Oh, very, very similar to the gatekeeper at the Rainbow Bridge.
And you know, but the thing is these kind of themes come over and over. Like for instance, remember Romper Stomper, Bumper Boo?
Oh, I remember
exactly. I see you, Timmy.
In fact, when I was 5 years old, she lived 3 houses down the street from me. Miss Marianne.
Yep.
That was in Eugene, Oregon. And that's where she lived, and they did the show out of there.
Well, I have to tell you, I've had an interesting life. When occasionally people ask me as Professor Kringle to give a lecture on the history of Santa Claus. And a lot of people don't realize how much Christmas and the tradition of Santa Claus and so on and so forth has changed over the years. And it has changed remarkably.
I was just reading through some of the notes you provided me with before we started the show. It's
my PR elves are on their game.
Oh, yes. It's the original date of Christmas has shifted around a bit.
Oh, yes. Well, that was actually kind of a decision that was made by one of the popes. There has always been a winter celebration. Winter celebrations happened long before Christmas came along. And we're celebrated by giving gifts and decorating with green. That actually is happening hundreds and hundreds of years before Christmas actually got established. And the other thing to remember is that, you know, even if you look at the Bible, it doesn't make much sense for the shepherds to be in the field in the middle of winter.
That's true.
And
that's
so
true.
What essentially happened was is that particular pope, I think it was Julius, but I have to go back and check my notes. He decided that, what a coincidence, he was going to have Christmas around the same time as a whole bunch of other festivals were happening. Mithraeus, Saturnalia, and Calends, mm-hmm. and a few others. And so, look, now the Christians are celebrating at the same time as everybody else is celebrating, which is very convenient.
Well, and it certainly helps the sense of belonging.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so just to kind of give you some interesting tidbits. As we move through the timeline and as Christmas evolves, it changed. And some writers and authors had phenomenal impact. One thing, for instance, when people call me Kris Kringle, that's an attribution to Kris Kindle, the Christ child, because during the Reformation, they decided, we don't want to have anything to do with saints anymore. That's kind of a Catholic thing. We don't want to be involved with it. And then they asked, well, who's going to deliver the gifts? And that was decided to be the Christ child, which is a little awkward for a little baby to be delivering presents. And so they would dress up a young girl and give her a little candle crown, like the Saint Lucia mm-hmm. tradition. Mm-hmm. And she would come into the house, and she would often have some travelers with her. And she would deliver the gifts. And in the German tradition, the Christmas tree was put on the table, and they would put the gifts in the tree. They were handmade. They were like cookies and little toys. And then the Christ child would ring the bell, and the doors would open, and the kids would rush in and see this magical sight. They did not leave lit candles in trees for hours, that, just so you know. They were smarter than that. But what happens is later on, that German tradition, well, that, as you know, the English royal family married into the German royal family. And I think it was Victoria who said, her husband said, we are having a Christmas tree. And so they said, okay, we're going to have a Christmas tree. And a woodcut was made of it. And soon all the English had to have Christmas trees. Well, the Americans, as you know, we love watching the English nobility. And so what happens is they decided they were going to emulate it. Of course, in their version of the print, the crowns and tiaras were all taken off.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly the Christmas tree industry was born. But Americans decided they could do it one better. Instead of putting Christmas presents in the tree, we could put Christmas presents under the tree. And instead of having to make them all yourselves, why, we could have merchants make some things that we could wrap and put under the tree.
Well, because, you know, not everybody's a craftsperson.
Well, that's true, but just to give you a concept, that linkage between the commercial side and the traditional side resulted in $619 billion of Christmas-related industry.
That's
every year.
Jaw-dropping.
It is. Roughly one-eighth of everything sold is linked in some way to the Christmas, quote-unquote, industry. Which, again, if it hadn't had that linkage, a lot of what we understand about Christmas and everything probably wouldn't happen. Think about it this way. Robert May, who created Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, was working for Montgomery Ward. And when he worked for Montgomery Ward, he did Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and people liked it. And then later on, Gene Autry recorded the song, and then, oh my goodness, it took off. And now, lo and behold, I have to tell you, I believe Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is the third most recognized public identity or character creation on the planet.
So it's Superman, Mickey Mouse, and Rudolph?
Something like that. I would have to check the stats. But the thing is, you know, to me, at the North Pole, as human ideas and everything infiltrates, it starts to replicate on my side, too. And so suddenly, you know, back in the early days, I was not pictured as this really jolly, heavyset person. I was tall and dour, and I carried a crook, and I visited homes sometimes with a Wildermann, a scary person like Krampus, or what have you. And a lot of people misunderstand about Krampus, and they think he's a demon or that sort of thing. Back then, there was the duality of Christmas. Even I, back in the days of early America, was portrayed by people as the Belsnickel who traveled in packs with kind of rough furry things and switches in one hand and treats in the other. So my role throughout time has changed.
So the Krampus, we have been, I think within about the last 15 years, awareness of who the Krampus was has come back to the fore.
So he has his own opinions on things. So at some point you should probably interview him. But the Krampus that I know and care for was originally more of a nature spirit. And every little area of Europe has its Wildermann, its wild man. And so we see this in the Green Man. We see this in a lot of the local traditions and outfits. What happens is that he gets kind of commercialized by the Germans with Krampusnacht, and there we start to see more of a, for lack of a better term, a sexual tinge and maybe a slightly racist viewpoint. But let me ask you a question. It was his job to take away the naughty or nice. I mean, the naughty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a tisket, a tasket, you're going in the basket, right?
Oh, good heavens.
Right. Well, but think of it this way. If you were visiting those houses and there actually was somebody who was possessed, who better to deal with this problem?
Mm.
Right? So the simple truth is Krampus was there to represent the duality. And as Santa, when I go out and I meet with children and adults, because as far as I'm concerned, you're all children, right, as old as I am. When I go out and meet, almost everyone is on the nice list because I can find good in everybody. But occasionally I do run into some occasionally naughty people. Imagine what had happened if Krampus had run into little baby Adolf Hitler.
Oh, yes.
Would World War II have happened? So, like I said, the imaginations of the world, the writers. Let me tell you a story about Washington Irving, because Washington Irving helped change my story immensely. When he was a young man, he was about 25 years old, and he came up with a brilliant, brilliant idea. He was working for a couple of printing companies, and as he was working for these printing companies, he wrote a book. I believe it was Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York. Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York. And that's where you see St. Nicholas. It's basically a story about the Dutch colonizing New York, but it's done from the perspective of, he treats them much like hobbits or dwarves. And you hear, in the story as it's written, you see St. Nicholas arriving, and he's first pictured as the bow spirit on this magical boat called the Good Vrouw, which is completely round. It can go in any direction it wants, sideways, backwards, what have you. And it has flying buttresses. It is big in the front and big in the back, and is supposedly made in the image of the harbor master's wife in Rotterdam. So anyhow, this ship, the Good Vrouw, on the front of it as the bowsprit is a drawing of me with a big hat and wearing knickers and a big pipe sticking out of my mouth. And that's St. Nicholas arriving in the New World. You kind of get a little feeling of that, like in Neil Gaiman's books, American Gods, you know, how the gods got to America. So, not that I'm a god by any stretch of the imagination, but what happens is he describes my visits in America, and that's where you first see Santa Claus flying for the first time. And St. Nicholas helps out the Dutch, not just on Christmas, but all over. Well, when Washington Irving, who I consider one of America's first fantasy writers, he comes up with a brilliant viral marketing campaign. He publishes ads in all the papers saying, Dietrich Knickerbocker, you've skipped out on your hotel bill, but you left your book, The History of the Dutch in New York, Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York. And if you do not come back and pay your hotel bill, I'm going to start publishing chapters in the newspaper as a way to make my money back. I bought your bill, so I have the book. There never was a Dietrich Knickerbocker.
Aha!
This is brilliant. And so what happens is he starts publishing chapters in the local papers. People love it. But more importantly, people start seeing Dietrich Knickerbocker. They see him on this bridge, or they talk to him over here, and so on and so forth.
It's like Elvis.
And who, by the way, Elvis, love the man. He keeps a lot of the music going at the North Pole. Anyway, so what happens is that book has a very seminal influence on how Santa Claus is seen. Well, the next person who really steps up to bat is Charles Dickens.
Right? Yes.
Now,
yes.
You remember, all the writers of that time period had a big problem. There was almost no copyright law. And so as soon as Charles Dickens creates a Christmas Carol, which, by the way, another brilliant publishing move, he self-publishes essentially in these little tiny books, and he does it in roughly about 3 months from beginning to end, writing, publishing, artwork, covers, everything. It sells out immediately. But the problem is that they take his book, throw it on a boat, it goes to the United States, and it is duplicated, and he gets none of the royalties. Poor Charles Dickens, who is always, you know, one step away from being poor, he ended up having to tour the United States and do readings to make any of his money off of his own work. And it was not just happening in the United States. It was happening in England. People were making plays of his amazingly successful book, A Christmas Carol. They were doing plays, and he was getting none of the royalties.
This sounds like the modern music industry.
It was crazy. He actually went and wrote reviews on plays that, based on his material, that he was not getting any part of.
Oh boy!
He actually fell in love with one of the actresses, and in his second marriage, I believe, he ended up getting married to her and all that. But I mean, And there were also several other novels that followed A Christmas Carol. But A Christmas Carol has not been out of print since it was first published. To this day, is still being printed. But Charles Dickens tapped into something really important, and it was the idea of targeted anonymous giving. Because he had grown up poor. His family had been in the poorhouse. One day, he went to one of the workplaces where the children were essentially being forced into industrial labor, and he saw this, and his heart fell out, and he decided he was going to somehow deal with this. And so he wrote A Christmas Carol. And we see that journey that Scrooge goes through. Now, you notice when Scrooge, after he has a visit with the three ghosts, and which, by the way, visits by ghosts during the Christmas season are very traditional. In that part of the world, even Shakespeare reflected on that this was a protected time, that evil spirits and so on and so forth, because of the magic, would not attack. But ghosts would visit with the tales and the glories and scary ghost stories of Christmases long, long ago. Well, there's the ghost stories. And they come and they give a revelation to Scrooge. And he opens up the doors and he says, boy, is that Christmas goose still available in the window? Yes, my lord. Well, he offers some money. But what that means is at that time, it was just a normal work day. They were not celebrating Christmas in the way we do today. And so not around that very same time period, we have the publication of The Night Before Christmas, A Visit from St. Nicholas. It was originally published anonymously, and then it's later attributed to Clement Clark Moore, which, interesting tidbit, Clement Clark Moore's father was the one who gave last rites to Hamilton as he was dying after the duel.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no. But Clement Clark Moore was an interesting fellow. He was wealthy. He owned a good chunk of the land in Manhattan. And he was part of a group called the Knickerbockers. And the Knickerbockers didn't want they were having a real problem, because up to that point, Christmas was about status and wealth and partying. They had Calathumpian bands that were going out and raising all sorts of ruckus. Remember, back at that point, people would come and wassail for you. They would come into your house. They would open the door and come in and party for you. And if you were wealthy, people were hitting you up all the time. Christmas gift, right? And so the wealthy people were kind of a little worried about what was going on in Philadelphia and New York. Well, one of the greatest feats of social engineering was about to happen. And so when Clement Clark Moore, or whoever actually wrote the poem, maybe it was him, comes out with The Night Before Christmas, he was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. This is not a tall bishop. Dour bishop with a crook coming into your house. This is now a short, round, comical, jovial character who's in your house. And so this is the point where I, as a character, start to be less of a religious character and start to become more of a secular character. Well, as this happens, as Santa Claus starts to evolve, what else happens is the Knickerbockers, an industry springs up about how I look and how and what I do, and it becomes about family.
So all this happened about, this is fairly recent history in your terms. Oh, this is about 200 years ago.
Yes, exactly. And what a lot of people don't realize is that two women had very very important influence on what we consider Christmas today. One is Sarah Josepha Hale, editor of Godey's Ladies' Book, and that was one of the most important influential periodicals in the Civil War. It had a circulation of 150,000.
Wow.
Right, back then. She's also the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Ah, okay.
Uh-huh. And so so when Queen Victoria decided to have Christmas trees and presents under the Christmas trees, that's about the time she started pushing out the idea that Christmas was about domesticity and about children. And it went from being about feasting and wassailing and partying, and it started to become more about families. And so a lot of other people started jumping in on the bandwagon. And then Mapes Dodge, the editor of the St. Nicholas magazine, had some of the best writers in all the Western society contributing to the body of lore. And these two periodicals helped shape what we think of as Christmas today. And by the way, I believe it was Sarah Josepha Hale, my apologies, was also the one who gave us Thanksgiving as an American culture.
That's so she's responsible for a few very pivotal memes in modern society.
In that time period, women did not have that much influence in society.
So and she was even more remarkable for this.
Remarkable. It changed the nature between the night before Christmas and the work of these ladies. And which, by the way, Mrs. Claus was seen as an advocate for human rights and a suffragist and a promoter of child welfare and domesticity. And so the whole focus of Christmas changed at that point. And then, of course, the linkage between the gifts under the tree linked the capitalistic viewpoint, and suddenly the merchants and everything had an interest in promoting this idea. It was this very rare and weird synergistic moment where our society changed in how we see Christmas or the Yule season. And by the way, I totally appreciate, as Santa Claus, as St. Nicholas, as Nikolai of Myra, I totally appreciate all the other religious viewpoints of that time period. I will say happily, Happy Hanukkah to my friends, because to me, the idea of targeted anonymous giving is one of the fundamental principles of the Jewish faith. And so the 8 days of light work for me as well. And so I will, when I visit people, I will happily tell traditional Jewish stories, you know, Moshe and the Christmas, Moshe and the Hanukkah miracle and Herschel and the Hanukkah goblins and so on and so forth, because I love those stories. But I actually talked to a rabbi and he said that targeted anonymous giving technically wasn't a mitzvah. It was the third column of the Torah.
Really?
It was even more, fundamental.
Core to the beliefs.
Exactly. But you see this in Diwali, you see this in so many other traditions. It's a time, because think of this, if we go all the way back, before established religions per se, the winter months are when originally mankind didn't know if the sun was going to come back. The earth has gone fallow, it is cold. It's one of the first times they get a chance to eat fresh meat, because the livestock, you're going to have to slaughter some, because not all of them are going to be able to survive because there just isn't enough food for them, enough fodder. And it has to be cold enough that you can produce the meat and it won't spoil. And so it's now cold enough to do that. This is also at the time where all the grain has been gathered, the grape has been gathered, and everything has started to ferment. And now you can have freshly made beer and wine and there's fresh meat. And now you're not out there working the fields constantly. And so we gather in the dark. And we light and we bring in what is green, the mistletoe, the evergreen pines and everything. And we celebrate ourselves to make it through that hard point. Because the hard point is not technically Christmas. The hard point is going to be the spring. Because by then, most of your resources have gone. And it's when those first green shoots come out of the ground, when those first animals migrate back up into your area, if they don't come early enough, you will die. And so when they celebrated around those lights and celebrated, you know, gathering together and as you know, back in the Middle Ages, no hand was ever idle. You were constantly working. For instance, clothing, every item was handmade, which, by the way, kind of gives us our tradition of Boxing Day. Because if it weren't for the rich nobles handing on their clothes to the next person, a lot of the people would never have enough clothing to wear. And so giving gifts and socks and so on and so forth is part of the tradition. In Iceland, if you don't get some new clothing on Christmas, the Christmas cat will come and eat you.
Oh, Christmas cat.
Oh, yes. And they've got 13 Christmas trolls up there as well. So I keep a stern eye on those.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Every country has different traditions. When I travel to the UK, I get mince pies and sherry. When I go to Scotland, I get a wee dram. And Ireland, of course, you know, a touch of Guinness. And Sweden, a nice cup of black coffee. And Australia, a nice cold beer. And so everywhere I go, in Nigeria, they make me fish soup. In I head south, I get tamales, pan de escuela. There's so many wonderful Christmas traditions.
So much giving.
It really is. But if you think about it, it's part of a ritual. somebody was making a joke the other day. If vampires have a problem getting into houses, why is it that Santa Claus does? Right? He's a magical creature as well, correct? Well, the answer to that is that when you put out the cookies and milk and decorate for Christmas, that's an invitation to me. Which is not such a bad thing, because what's the one thing that a vampire would not want to do? He would not want to come into a house that was recently blessed. If Santa were there, is he not the bishop?
Yes. Oh, yes.
That's right. Santa Claus, keeping America safe from vampires. Sparkly or no, which, by the way, the reason I have the sparkles in my beard is because of the fairies. I try, but it gets in there.
Yeah, it's fairy dust must be everywhere.
It is. It is. It can be actually quite problematic. Pixies, fairies. We've got Yetis, Sasquatches, all sorts of interesting things. Claws Valley is its own little pocket area. We do get seasons. Our summer is a little shorter and more intense. Our winter a little longer. But yeah, there are places in the Great Wood. I do not go and I leave those creatures alone.
My. Oh, my. I understand that... one of the places you've been, one of the more remarkable places you've been, was you've actually been to orbit.
Oh, yes. So, that was in the 1960s.
1965.
65, there you go. Hey, it all starts to blend in after a while. So what happened was Houston was down there, ground control, and all of a sudden, I think it was Gemini, right?
I think so. Yes, Gemini.
They report, Houston, we see an unidentified object. Can't quite make it out. It seems to be paralleling our orbit. And Houston is like, we don't see anything. Our radar, you know, so on and so forth. Understand technology was fairly. Mm-hmm. And then they heard jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. And the astronauts had smuggled jingle bells and a harmonica into the cabin, which, might I add, is no small feat because every ounce was accounted for in those capsules. Well, those two items are now in the Smithsonian, believe it or not.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Yes. And so, yes, that was the first time I was seen in orbit. Although, to be honest with you, I've been gathering lunar frost from the dark side of the moon for a while now.
That must be quite a challenge because... H3
is a very potent and useful material.
Well, and the darkest parts of the moon are actually 340. They're near absolute zero.
Absolutely. And so, but again, I mean, if you think that about the sleigh moving at 1,800 miles per second, if I didn't have, well, let me put it to you this way. If you thought about the millions of tons of gifts the amount of tonnage that I am moving with my sleigh at the velocity that I'm sleighing, that is in my sleigh, if the gravitational and inertial compensators on my sleigh suddenly gave up, it would destroy the planet.
Yes, I imagine it would. That is a tremendous amount of energy.
Right. It would be. It would make that little impact in Siberia look like a pop gun. So another interesting thing is around 1087. I had passed away, and my bones were in a tomb. And I started expressing oil, manna. And this is during the time of relics. And so, you know, you could walk down the street. Hey, buddy, you want a piece of the true cross, the cross, mm-hmm. or, you know, your very own Shroud of Turin washcloths, you know. What have you. Well, no, because at that time, during the time of relics, you couldn't even establish a church without the knuckle bone of St. Finbar, so on and so forth. It was a big industry. And so the monks who were down there, well, the the expansion of the Muslim faith is about to come through that whole area, through Spain, Italy, so on and so forth. And it's coming up in that direction. Well, the Italians show up on the shore and go, so we hear you've got this saint here in the tomb. And they said, yes, and he's wonderful, and he is a saint. His body did not corrupt, and so it smells of flowers. This manna, it will heal you. And they said, it would be a shame if something were to happen to him, like, you know, a bunch of guys were to grab him and throw him onto a boat. What? And that's exactly what the Italians did, is they grabbed him, the body, I should say, and they brought it to Italy, and to Bari, Italy, and they built a beautiful St. Nicholas Cathedral. And my body was re-entombed there. And apparently I like it because I'm starting to express oil again, which in the Catholic faith is kind of odd. They actually have a term for this, myroblite. There are about 30-some-odd saints that express manna.
That's... I had no idea. That's,
right.
Wow.
Well, the monks who were down there were not thrilled with this because that was their, you know, their main reason why people would come and make pilgrimages.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, anywhere the sailors went, they essentially set up churches to St. Nicholas. And so that's how the belief in me just traveled the world. I became the principal saint of Russia, Nikolai Thaumaturgus, Nicholas the Wonder Worker. But here's where it gets a little weird, as if that wasn't weird enough. I believe it was in the 17th century, there was a lady named Teofania de Adamo. There were women who had inconvenient husbands. And Madame de Adamo was a world-class poisoner. Her poisons were so powerful, it was said that three doses, and understand, this is, you know, during the Medicis and so on and so forth, this was considered an art form. By the way, poisoning was never an elegant art. But supposedly, her poisons were so good, they could not be detected. And so everybody wanted to know. Well, so anyhow, suddenly the Italians kind of became aware that there were all these rich young widows running around, and all their inconvenient husbands had passed away, and they would give the first dose, and the person would get sick, and a couple of weeks later, the second dose, and the person would say, oh, I'm not getting better, I'm going to deal with my affairs, and the third dose would take him out. And then suddenly you've got a rich widow mm-hmm. who is young and beautiful and wealthy. Well, so the authorities caught on to this, and they essentially found the lady. And the poison was called Aqua Tofano. And the Aqua Tofano poison was being moved around in little bottles called Manna di San Nicola, the oil of St. Nicholas.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
It was said that she killed over 600 people.
That's...
They are still looking for her recipe to this very day.
That's astonishing.
Yes. And so, anyhow... Which brings us kind of to the future, because where I cannot be, I have my friends who are Santa's helpers, because I can't be everywhere, especially now. And so I have people who portray me, and they have the belief and the goals of St. Nicholas. Even if they are not Christian, they might be Jewish or pagan or what have you. They have the ideals, which the ideals are greater than any one religion. The idea of generosity and inspiration and so on and so forth. Well, Santa's helpers are out there, and they occasionally get knighted into the Order of St. Nicholas. And guess what they use to consecrate them?
That same manna.
The manna di San Nicola. So if I were standing in that line, I would not be first. No, that's fine. Skip a bit, brother. Skip a bit. So, yes, there are all sorts of weird, strange little... things going on in the Christmas tradition. And, you know, and so when I talk to people today, it's ironic that people have forgotten the main idea behind Christmas. And that is the idea of targeted anonymous giving. That's the heart. And it doesn't matter what tradition you are. If you're willing to go out and do that. Now, here's a question. Why don't I deliver frozen fish or used tires?
Because these things are things that we need to survive or to make our lives tolerable, but they don't necessarily bring joy.
And that's a key point. Joy is actually a very important part. Yes, joy, happiness, you know, expressing love. But here's the thing. Why do I target children?
Because of all of us, they are the most capable of hope.
They aren't cynical. They haven't had a chance to be exposed to a lot of the bitterness that is in the world. And so what I love to do is I love to deliver toys that will inspire them. And so if I deliver a chemistry set or a graphic novel or ballet slippers or something, that child can go on to be a great scientist or a great artist or so on and so forth. And so that's one of the reasons why I focus on children and why I give toys, because the simple truth is pachyderms to platypuses, all life forms love to play. And when we learn to play, we learn how to be better people. That's the contract of naughty or nice. It's not that I'm looking to punish people. I'm trying to inspire people to be their better selves. And that's why I deliver presents to children, is because I want, in particular, because I, believe me, as far as I'm concerned, 8 to 80, they're all children, right? But when I deliver these things to children, it gives them a chance to be inspired, to play and to have fun. And to, because ever watch children play, you know, and here's the shark, and it's going to bite off Barbie's head, right? Well, but what these children are doing is they're role-playing what it is to be a person in the world. It's a scary place. And so if I could get in there and show them that somebody loves them, somebody they don't even know, and that by being nice and helping other people, right, the world is a better place, that's my mission. And so that's the question people don't often ask, is why do you do what you do, Santa Claus? And so my answer is that I'm spreading the ideals of Christmas and I'm trying to inspire people. That's why I do it.
Do you have any favorite stories from recent visits?
Oh, it's funny. Everywhere I go, I am impacted by how people see me. I was at a senior center not long ago, and people don't know if it's me or if it's one of my helpers, of course. And so the older ladies are sitting on my lap. I haven't sat in a man's lap in 20 years, you know, and the men are like, you're awfully cute for Santa Claus. And, I would like a Ferrari. To which I respond, Matchbox or Mattel? You know, I make toys, right? But anyhow, I mean, and I've had, you know, gentlemen 350 pounds each on both knees kissing me on my cheeks. You know, Santa is so far above the whole issues of, you know, LGBTQ, so on and so forth. As far as I'm concerned, everyone is a child deserving of love. But at a certain point, they said, okay, Santa, if we could have you come into the other room. They brought me down a hallway and everything, and there was a touch button. And they opened the door, and, you know, I'm thinking, this is a little odd. Do they have a cooler full of Santa suits? You know, mm-hmm. Our pelts are worth something. So I go in there, and it was a room for people with Alzheimer's and those sort of problems. And senility, so on and so forth. And I see an older lady. And I walk over and I said, hello, young lady. Because as Santa, I'm always the oldest person in the room.
Of course.
And she kind of looked at me for a second and said, Santa! And so we started talking. And at this place was in California. And almost nobody from California is from California in this area. And we start talking about snow and the smell of snow and the sound of snow and talking about Christmas and when she was young. We talked for about 5 minutes. And I gave her a hug and a candy cane. And I got up and I started to walk away. And a couple of staff came over and they touched me on the sleeve and they said, Santa, that's the first time she's spoken in 6 months. She's been here 6 months and that's the first time she's spoken.
Wow.
That's the power of the suit. That's the power of the role I play. It is iconic. It can stir some of those most precious and primal memories. And so for me, it was a truly touching moment. The other day, I was visiting a parochial school. And I'd gotten done telling stories and everything because Santa loves telling stories and singing. Not that I have any problem with electronic medium, but one of the beautiful things about Krypton Radio is that when you listen to a program, you get a chance to actively imagine it. And when you imagine something, it becomes relevant to you. It means something to you. That's why I really miss the days of the Shadow Knows and all those old radio dramas. Oh, I love them. Anyway, so I was telling stories to the children and everything, and the deal is that they have to hold the children back so that the kids don't try to climb into the sleigh with me. And so I'm beating feet across the parking lot and getting ready to get out of there when all of a sudden this little girl comes out of the darkness, and she looks at me and says, "Santa?" And she starts crying. I mean, and it was obvious she'd been crying for a while. And I look around, I don't see anybody. I'm like, are you okay? Are your parents here? And her father comes out of the darkness, and he's a hipster with the beard and the tats and everything. And he looks at me and he says, "She thought she was going to miss you." Apparently, they had not gotten the memo that all the other parents had gotten. And so by the time he got there, I was going to be gone. And the girl had learned this and was just crying her eyes out.
Aww.
And so I turn and I look back, and here's this teacher holding a tide, a tsunami of children back by raw will. And I call her over and I get down on one knee and I said, "Come here, sweetie." And I put her on my knee. And I started to talk to her about Christmas and how I was going to visit on Christmas Eve and that I would see her, but she probably wouldn't see me. But I wanted to remind her that Santa loves her and I love everyone and there's nothing you can do about that. Well, and I handed her some candy canes to give to her brothers and sisters. And she quickly told me what she wanted for Christmas. And I said, "All right, sweetie, can you do me a favor? You see all those children down there? Can you go down there and tell them that you just saw Santa Claus?" She gave me a big hug and a big smile, and off she went. And I looked up the father, and tears were running down his face. And I shook his hand, and I said, "Merry Christmas," and I gave him a hug. And I said, "And you better go catch her." And so he ran off after her. But I knew, as I always know, in that moment, that how I treated her at that key moment was going to change how she felt about Christmas the rest of her life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so when I deliver what I deliver, whether people see me or not, whether they see me and I'm, you know, my skin is black, is dark, or my skin is light, or whether I look Oriental or Caucasian or what have you, it's not me. It's the ideals. It's the ideals of Christmas. And that's why the elves threw in with me. That's why we do what we do at the North Pole. Is we are trying to help humanity. We are trying to help civilization. And we love artists. We love writers. We love singers. Any one of those things, because belief is a power. And that power helps make what we do, helps us make our magic. Something to remember about Christmas. To become a better, to become somebody who believes in the concept of civilization, of something bigger than yourself, you have to understand belief. And so when a little child may not understand the concept of God, but they can understand the very simple concept of, I was good and somebody gave me something. That's one of the first contracts of a civilization. And so the problem people don't understand is that they say, well, I feel awkward about talking about Christmas to children. And we, you know, we don't necessarily believe in Santa and so on and so forth. I would offer this suggestion that belief is a learned ability. One of my favorite authors, Terry Pratchett, who wrote The Hogfather, which is a wonderful novel if you ever get a chance to read it.
I have read it.
Oh, what a great. And in that, The Hogfather is my analog in that realm. And there's a point where Death's niece, I think it is, she's talking to the great spirit of the universe.
His granddaughter.
Yes, his granddaughter. And she says, well, what's the point of it all? You know, the Hogfather, the Tooth Fairy, and so on and so forth. And the Great Spirit says to her, they have to believe the little things to believe the big things. And she says, you mean like the Tooth Fairy and the Hogfather and the Christmas Platypus or what have you? And I'm probably misphrasing this. And he says, yes, but they have to believe in that before they can believe in the big things, like equality and mercy and justice. And she says, those don't equate at all. Those are totally different things. And the Great Spirit says, really? Take the entire universe and grind it through the finest sieve that ever existed and show me one molecule of mercy or justice?
And she said, without mercy or justice, what's the point? The Great Spirit looked at her and said, exactly. Those things, these intangible things, the things that we believe in, are the things that make existence worthwhile. And so when we teach children and people to believe in things greater than themselves, that mechanism of belief, that allows them to believe in things like concepts like democracy, like things like compassion, ideas that of thinking of somebody else's life journey other than their own. And so I would say, perhaps it's not your cup of tea, but perhaps learning the mechanism of belief is one of the most important things we can do. That idea of inspiration and play and belief is fundamental to what we do.
Santa Claus, it has been, it's been an enlightening discussion. I'm so very glad you stopped by, and I think it's going to be a marvelous Christmas this year.
Well, Gene, I have to be honest with you. I'm pretty glad that you are on the nice list. It's been a while. not to divulge anything, but as a child, he was such a scamp. And so he was riding the line quite a few times. Not because he was necessarily a bad child, but let's just say his natural scientific endeavors got him into a few problematic situations.
Yeah.
So I am very, very happy that you invited me. And by the way, I would love to give a huge shout out to the whole Krypton Radio staff. They are amazing and wonderful. And if you don't listen to the other programs, you should. And also, we just passed Hanukkah, but a happy Hanukkah to your lovely lady and to all the people of that tradition. And for all the pagan people out there, good Yule and Festivus and whatever holiday you celebrate, I want to wish you all a happy holiday and, in my case, a Merry Christmas. May I give you a big Merry Christmas?
Absolutely.
Merry! Whoa. And Santa almost knocked something over. Let's try that again. Merry Christmas! Ho, ho, ho!
You have been listening to episode 206 of Krypton Radio's weekly production of The Event Horizon for December 15th, 2018. Our guest today has been St. Nicholas, known equally as Santa Claus, Pierre Noel, and a long list of other names from countries around the world as portrayed by Santa True, also known as True Thomas the Storyteller. Your host this evening was Gene Turnbow, as Susan Fox, our other co-host, has had the night off this evening. This episode will air again tomorrow at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, that Sunday, and two more times on the following Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. Once all of the air times have passed, you will find this episode and others on iTunes, Stitcher, and on our own website at KryptonRadio.com as podcasts. Krypton Radio is listener-supported sci-fi geek culture radio, and the vast majority of our funding comes from listeners just like you. We are asking you to visit patreon.com/KryptonRadio and donate a dollar or two a month to help keep the station on the air. Be a hero and go pledge. Give the gift of geek music to your friends by helping support the world's only full-time sci-fi geek culture radio station. That's patreon.com/KryptonRadio. The Event Horizon title sequence was written and produced by Gene Turnbow. The science officer was played by sci-fi illustrator Mark Schirmeister. The engineer was Christian B. McGuire, and the navigator was Christine Cherry, and the captain was voiced by science fiction grandmaster Larry Niven. This program is copyright 2018 by Krypton Media Group Incorporated. The Event Horizon on Krypton Radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.